diagnosis, particularly in a complex case, is given a large number of facts about the patient's condition and must absorb those facts and then combine them with relevant medical knowledge to come to a conclusion. This doctor must do at least three different things: assimilate facts about the patient, recall relevant medical knowledge, and use the facts and medical knowledge to identify possible diagnoses and choose the right one. For all of these activities, a more sophisticated mental representation makes the process faster and more efficient, and sometimes makes it possible, period. To see how this works, I'll borrow one of Sanders' medical mysteries, one that only a handful of readers solved correctly, out of more than 200 who sent in answers. A 39-year-old male police officer came to his doctor complaining of an intense earache. It felt like a knife in his ear, and noting that his right pupil was smaller than his left. He had had the earache once before and had visited an urgent care center, where he was diagnosed with an infection and given a prescription for antibiotics. When it got better in a couple of days, he thought nothing more about it. But the earache reappeared 2 months later, and this time the antibiotics did no good. The doctor thought it was probably just a sinus infection, but because of the issue with the pupil, the patient was referred to an eye doctor. That doctor couldn't make a diagnosis and referred the patient to a specialist. The specialist, a neuro-ophthalmologist, immediately recognized the small pupil as a symptom of a particular syndrome, but had no idea what might cause that syndrome in an otherwise healthy man, and how it might all be related to the intense ear pain. So he asked a number of questions. Have you felt weakness anywhere? What about numbness or tingling? Have you been lifting weights recently? When the patient replied that he had been lifting weights for several months, the doctor asked one more question. Had he experienced any serious pain in his head or neck after lifting? Yes, he'd had an intense post-workout headache a couple of weeks earlier. The doctor could finally figure out what was wrong. At first, the essential step in solving this mystery might seem to be recognizing what syndrome could cause one pupil to be smaller than the other, but this was actually pretty straightforward. It required having learned about that syndrome at some point and being able to recall its symptoms. It is called Horner syndrome, and it is caused by damage to a nerve that runs behind the eye. The damage hurts the eye's ability to dilate and often limits the movement of the eyelid covering that eye, and indeed, when the specialist looked closely, he could see that that eyelid was not opening fully. Several readers identified Horner syndrome correctly, but were stymied by how that might be connected to the ear pain. In this particular sort of challenge, piecing together a number of clues, the mental representations of expert doctors come to the fore. A doctor diagnosing a patient with a complex set of symptoms must take in a great deal of information without knowing ahead of time which is most relevant and which might be red herrings. It's impossible to assimilate all that information as random facts. The limitations of short-term memory will not allow it. So it must be understood against the background of the relevant medical knowledge. But what is relevant? Before a diagnosis is made, it is difficult to know what the various bits of clinical information might imply and what sort of medical conditions they might be related to. Medical students, whose mental representations of diagnostic medicine are still rudimentary, tend to associate symptoms with the particular medical conditions that they're familiar with and jump quickly to conclusions. They fail to generate multiple options. Even many less experienced doctors do the same thing. Thus, when the police officer went to the urgent care clinic complaining of an earache, the doctor there assumed the problem was an infection of some sort, which would have been the correct answer in most cases, and didn't worry about the seemingly irrelevant fact that one of the patient's pupils was acting up. Unlike medical students, expert diagnosticians have built sophisticated medical representations that let them consider a number of different facts at once, even events that at first might not seem germane. This is a major advantage of highly developed mental representations. You can assimilate and consider a great deal more information at once. Research on expert diagnosticians has found that they tend to see symptoms and other relevant data not as isolated bits of information, but as pieces of larger patterns. in much the same way that grandmasters see patterns among chess pieces, rather than a random assortment of pieces. And, just as chess masters' representations allow them to quickly generate a number of possible moves and then zero in on the best one, experienced diagnosticians come up with a number of possible diagnoses and then analyze the various alternatives to select the most likely one. Of course, the doctor may ultimately decide that none of the options work, but the process of reasoning through each of them may well have led to still other possibilities. This ability to generate a number of likely diagnoses and carefully reason through them distinguishes expert diagnosticians from the rest. The solution to the medical mystery described in the New York Times required precisely that sort of approach. First, come up with possible explanations for why a patient should have both Horner's syndrome and a knife-like pain in the ear, and then analyze each possibility to find the right answer. Stroke was one possibility, but the patient had nothing in his background that indicated he might have had a stroke. Shingles could also produce the patient's two symptoms, but he had none of the usual signs of shingles, such as blisters or a rash. A third possibility was a tear in the wall of the carotid artery, which runs right alongside the nerve affected in Horner's and also passes through the ear. A slight tear in the artery can allow blood to leak through the inner walls of the artery, causing a bulge in its outer wall, which can press on the nerve to the face and, in rare cases, also press on a nerve to the ear. With this in mind, the specialist asked the patient questions about lifting weights and headaches. It is known that weightlifting can sometimes tear the carotid artery, and such a pain would normally be associated with some sort of headache or neck pain. When the patient answered yes, the specialist decided that a tear in the carotid artery was the most likely diagnosis. An MRI scan verified that diagnosis, and the patient was put on blood thinners to prevent the formation of a blood clot, and was told to avoid any sort of exertion for the several months that it would take the blood vessel to heal. The key to the successful diagnosis wasn't merely having the necessary medical knowledge, but having that knowledge organized and accessible in a way that allowed the doctor to come up with possible diagnoses and to zero in on the most likely. The superior organization of information is a theme that appears over and over again in the study of expert performers. This is true even for something as mundane as insurance sales. A recent study examined knowledge about multi-line insurance, life, home, auto, and commercial, in 150 agents. Not surprisingly, the highly successful agents, as determined by their sales volumes, knew more about the various insurance products than the less successful agents. But more to the point, researchers found that the highly successful agents had much more complex and integrated knowledge structures, what we are calling mental representations, than the less successful agents. In particular, the better agents had much more highly developed if-then structures. If these things are true about a client, then say this or do that. Because their insurance knowledge was better organized, the best agents could figure out what to do more quickly and more accurately in any given situation, and this made them much more effective agents. Planning. Before experienced rock climbers begin a climb, they will look over the entire wall and visualize the path they are going to take, seeing themselves moving from hold to hold. This ability to create a detailed mental representation of a climb before embarking on it is something that only comes with experience. More generally, mental representations can be used to plan a wide variety of areas, and the better the representation, the more effective the planning. Surgeons, for example, will often visualize an entire surgery before making the first incision. They use MRIs, CT scans, and other images to take a look inside the patient and identify potential trouble spots. Then they devise a plan of attack. Developing such mental representations of a surgery is one of the most challenging and most important things a surgeon can do, and more experienced surgeons generally create more sophisticated and more effective representations of these procedures. The representations not only guide the surgery, but they also serve to provide a warning when something unexpected and potentially dangerous happens in the surgery. When an actual surgery diverges from the surgeon's mental representation, he or she knows to slow down, rethink the options, and if necessary, formulate a new plan in response to the new information. Relatively few of us climb rocks or perform surgeries, but almost everyone writes, and the process of writing offers us an excellent example of how mental representations can be used in planning. I myself have become quite familiar with this arena over the past couple of years as I've worked on PEAK, and many of the people reading this book will have done some writing lately as well, whether it has been a personal letter or a business memo, a blog post, or a book. There has been quite a bit of research into the representations people use when writing, and the research has demonstrated a profound difference between the methods used by expert writers and those used by novices. Consider, for example, the answer that a sixth grader offered when asked about the strategy he used in writing an essay. "I have a whole bunch of ideas and write down till my supply of ideas is exhausted. Then I might try to think of more ideas up to the point where you can't get any more ideas that are worth putting down on paper, and then I would end it." This approach is actually pretty typical, not just for sixth graders, but for many people who don't write for a living. The representation of the writing is simple and direct. There's a topic, and there are various thoughts that the writer has on the topic, often loosely organized by relevance or importance, but sometimes by category or some other pattern. A slightly more sophisticated representation might include some sort of introduction at the beginning and a conclusion or summary at the end, but that's about it. This approach to writing has been called knowledge telling, because it is little more than telling the reader whatever comes into your head. Expert writers do it very differently. Consider how my co-author and I put this book together. First, we had to figure out what we wanted the book to do. What did we want readers to learn about expertise? What concepts and ideas were important to introduce? How should a reader's ideas about training and potential be changed by reading this book? Answering questions like these gave us our first rough mental representation of the book, our goals for it, what we wanted it to accomplish. Of course, as we worked more and more on the book, that initial image evolved. But it was a start. Now we started sketching out how we would accomplish our goals for the book. What general topics did we need to cover? Obviously, we needed to explain what deliberate practice is. How would we do that? Well, first we would need to explain how people normally practice and the limitations of that approach. And then we would discuss purposeful practice, and so on. At that point, we were envisioning various approaches we could use to reach our goals for the book and weighing them, seeing which options seemed best. As we made our choices, we gradually honed our mental representation of the book until we had something that seemed to meet all of our goals. The simplest way to imagine our mental representation at this stage is to think back to the old outlining technique you learned back in junior high English class. We prepared an outline of chapters, each focused on a particular topic and covering various aspects of that topic. But the representation of the book that we had created was far richer and more complex than a simple outline. We knew, for instance, why each piece was there and what we wanted to accomplish with it. And we had a clear idea of the book's structure and logic, why one topic followed another, and the interconnections among the various pieces. We found that this process also forced us to think carefully about how we conceptualized deliberate practice ourselves. We started off with what seemed to be a clear idea of deliberate practice and how to explain it. But as we tried to describe it briefly in a non-technical way, sometimes we found that it just wasn't working as well as we would have liked. That would lead us to rethink the best way to explain a concept or to make a point. For example, when we presented our initial proposal to our agent, Elise Cheney, she and her colleagues had trouble understanding deliberate practice clearly. In particular, they didn't get what separates deliberate practice from other forms of practice, other than it is more effective. This was not their fault, but an indication that we hadn't made our explanation as readily intelligible as we'd thought. That forced us to rethink how we were presenting deliberate practice. In essence, to come up with a new and better mental representation of how we thought about it and how we wanted others to think about it. It soon occurred to us that the role of mental representations held the key to how we wanted to present deliberate practice. Initially, we had seen mental representations as being just one aspect of deliberate practice among many, that we would present to the reader. But now we began to see them as a central feature, perhaps the central feature of the book. The main purpose of deliberate practice is to develop effective mental representations, and as we will discuss shortly, mental representations in turn play a key role in deliberate practice. The key change that occurs in our adaptable brains in response to deliberate practice is the development of better mental representations, which in turn open up new possibilities for improved performance. In short, we came to see our explanation of mental representations as the keystone of the book, without which the rest of the book could not stand. There was a steady interplay between the writing of the book and our conceptualization of the topic, and as we looked for ways to make our messages clearer to the reader, we would come up with new ways to think about deliberate practice ourselves. Researchers refer to this sort of writing as knowledge transforming, as opposed to knowledge telling, because the process of writing changes and adds to the knowledge that the writer had when starting out. This is an example of one way in which expert performers use mental representations to improve their performance. They monitor and evaluate their performance, and when necessary, they modify their mental representations in order to make them more effective. The more effective the mental representation is, the better the performance will be. We had developed a certain mental representation of the book, but we found out that it had led us to a performance, the explanations in our original proposal, that was not as good as we wished, so we used the feedback we had gotten and modified the representation accordingly. This in turn led us to a much better explanation of deliberate practice. And so it went throughout the writing of the book. Although it was constantly evolving, our mental representation of the book guided us and informed our decisions about our writing. As we went along, we evaluated each piece, in the later stages with the help of our editor, Eamon Dolan, and when we found weaknesses, we tweaked the representation to fix the problem. Obviously, the mental representation for a book is much larger and more complex than one for a personal letter or a blog post. But the general pattern is the same. To write well, develop a mental representation ahead of time to guide your efforts, then monitor and evaluate your efforts, and be ready to modify that representation as necessary. Mental representations in learning. In general, mental representations aren't just the result of learning a skill. They can also help us learn. Some of the best evidence for this comes from the field of musical performance. Several researchers have examined what differentiates the best musicians from lesser ones, and one of the major differences lies in the quality of the mental representations the best ones create. When practicing a new piece, beginning and intermediate musicians generally lack a good, clear idea of how the music should sound, while advanced musicians have a very detailed mental representation of the music they use to guide their practice and ultimately their performance of a piece. In particular, they use their mental representations to provide their own feedback, so that they know how close they are to getting the piece right and what they need to do differently to improve. The beginners and intermediate students may have crude representations of the music that allow them to tell, for instance, when they hit a wrong note, but they must rely on feedback from their teachers to identify the more subtle mistakes and weaknesses. Even among beginning music students, it seems that differences in the quality of how the music is represented make a difference in how effective practice can be. About 15 years ago, two Australian psychologists, Gary McPherson and James Renwick, studied a number of children between the ages of 7 and 9 who were learning to play various instruments, the flute, the trumpet, the cornet, the clarinet, and the saxophone. Part of the study was to videotape the children as they practiced at home and then to analyze the practice sessions to understand what the children did to make their practice more or less effective. In particular, the researchers counted the number of mistakes a student made in practicing a piece the first time and the second time, and used the improvement from the first to the second as a measurement of how effectively the student was practicing. They found a wide variation in the amount of improvement. Of all the students they studied, a female cornet player in her first year of learning the instrument made the most mistakes, 11 per minute on average, on the first times playing a piece during practice sessions. On the second time through, she was still making the same mistakes 70% of the time, noticing and correcting only 3 out of every 10 mistakes. By contrast, the best first-year player, a boy who was learning the saxophone, made only 1.4 mistakes per minute on his first times through. And on the second time through, he was making the same mistakes only 20% of the time, correcting 8 out of every 10 mistakes. The difference in the percentage of corrections is particularly striking, because the saxophone player was already making many fewer mistakes, so he had much less room for improvement. All of the students had good attitudes and were motivated to improve, so McPherson and Renwick concluded that the differences among the students most likely lay, in large part, in how well the students were able to detect their mistakes. That is, how effective their mental representations of the musical pieces were. The saxophone player had a clear mental representation of the piece that allowed him to recognize most of his mistakes, remember them the next time, and correct them. The cornet player, on the other hand, didn't seem to have such a well-developed mental representation of what she was playing. The difference between the two was not in desire or effort, the researchers said. The cornet player just didn't have the same tools with which to improve as the saxophone player did. McPherson and Renwick didn't try to understand the precise nature of the mental representations, but other research indicates that the representations could have taken several forms. One would be an oral representation, a clear idea of what a piece should sound like. Musicians at every level use these to guide their practice and their play, and better musicians have far more detailed representations, which include not just the pitch and the length of the notes to be played, but their volume, rise and fall, intonation, vibrato, tremolo, and harmonic relationship with other notes, including notes played on other instruments by other musicians. Good musicians not only recognize these various qualities of musical sound, but know how to produce them on their own instruments, an understanding that requires its own sort of mental representation, which is, in turn, quite closely tied to the mental representation of the sounds themselves. The students McPherson and Renwick studied probably also had developed, to one degree or another, mental representations that connected notes written on a musical score with the fingering necessary to play those notes. Thus, if the saxophonist accidentally placed his fingers in the wrong position for a note, he would probably notice it not only because his horn produced the wrong sound, but also because his fingering felt off. That is, it didn't match his mental representation of where his fingers should be placed. While the study by McPherson and Renwick has the advantage of being very personal, we almost feel as though we know the cornet player and the saxophonist when we're done. It has the disadvantage of having observed only a few musicians in one school. Fortunately, its results are backed up by a British study of more than 3,000 music students, ranging from beginners to experts ready to enter a university-level conservatory. The researchers found, among other things, that the more accomplished music students were better able to determine when they'd made mistakes, and better able to identify difficult sections they needed to focus their efforts on. This implies that the students had more highly developed mental representations of the music they were playing and of their own performances, which allowed them to monitor their practice and spot mistakes. Furthermore, the more advanced music students also had more effective practice techniques. The implication is that they were using their mental representations not only to spot mistakes, but also to match appropriate practice techniques with the types of difficulties they were having with the music. In any area, not just musical performance, the relationship between skill and mental representation is a virtuous circle. The more skilled you become, the better your mental representations are. And the better your mental representations are, the more effectively you can practice to hone your skill. We can see a more detailed depiction of how an expert uses mental representations through a long-term collaboration between Roger Chaffin, a psychologist at the University of Connecticut, and Gabriella Imre, an internationally known pianist based in New Jersey. For years, they have been working together to understand what goes through Imre's head as she studies, practices, and performs a piece of music. Much of Chaffin's work with Imre is reminiscent of how I monitored Steve Falloon's development of mental representations for memorizing strings of digits. He observes her as she is learning a new piece of music and has her voice her thought process as she determines how she will play it. He also videotapes these practice sessions so that he has additional clues as to how Imre is approaching her task. In one series of sessions, Chaffin followed Imre as she spent more than 30 hours practicing the third movement of the Italian concerto of Johann Sebastian Bach, which she was scheduled to play for the first time. The first thing Imre did when she sight-read the piece was to develop what he called an artistic image, a representation of what the piece should sound like when she performed it. Now, Imre was not coming to this piece cold. She'd heard it many times. But the fact that she was able to create this mental image of the piece simply by reading the score indicates just how highly developed her mental representations of the piano are. Where most of us would see musical symbols on a page, she heard the music in her head. Much of what Imre did from that point on was figuring out how to perform the piece so that it matched her artistic image. She began by going through the entire piece and deciding exactly what fingering she would use. Where possible, she would use the standard fingering that pianists learn for particular series of notes. But there were places that required departing from the standard, because she wanted that particular passage to sound a certain way. She would try out different options, decide on one, and note it on the score. She also identified different moments in the composition that Chaffin called expressive turning points. For instance, a point where her playing would turn from light and lively to more measured and serious. Later, she would pick out cues in the music, short passages before a turning point or a technically difficult passage that, when she came to them, would serve as prompts to get ready for what was coming. She also picked out various places where she would add nuanced interpretations of the music. By putting all of these different elements into an overall map of the piece, Imre managed to do justice to both the forest and the trees. She formed an image of what the whole piece should sound like, while also giving herself clear images of the details she needed to pay close attention to as she was playing. Her mental representation combined what she thought the music was supposed to sound like with what Imre had figured out about how to make it sound that way. Although other pianists' mental representations would likely differ from Imre's in the specifics, their overall approaches are likely to be very similar. Her mental representation also allowed Imre to deal with a fundamental dilemma facing any classical pianist learning to play a piece. It is crucial that the musician practice and memorize the piece in such a way that the performance can be done almost automatically, with the fingers of each hand playing the proper notes with little or no conscious direction from the pianist. In this way, the piece can be performed flawlessly on stage in front of an audience, even if the pianist is nervous or excited. On the other hand, the pianist must have a certain amount of spontaneity in order to connect and communicate with the audience. Imre did this by using her mental map of the piece. She would play much of the piece just as she had always practiced it, with her fingers going through well-rehearsed motions. But she always knew exactly where she was in the piece, because she'd identified various points that served as landmarks. Some of these were performance landmarks that would signal to Imre that, for example, a change in fingering was approaching, while others were what Chaffin called expressive landmarks. These indicated places where she could vary her playing to capture a particular emotion, depending on how she felt and how the audience was responding. That allowed her to maintain spontaneity within the demanding constraints of performing a complicated piece before a live audience. Physical activities are mental, too. As we've just seen from several studies, musicians rely on mental representations to improve both the physical and cognitive aspects of their specialties. And mental representations are essential to activities we see as almost purely physical. Indeed, any expert in any field can be rightly seen as a high-achieving intellectual where that field is concerned. This applies to pretty much any activity in which the positioning and movement of a person's body is evaluated for artistic expression by human judges. Think of gymnastics, diving, figure skating, or dancing. Performers in these areas must develop clear mental representations of how their bodies are supposed to move to generate the artistic appearance of their performance routines. But even in areas where artistic form is not explicitly judged, it is still important to train the body to move in particularly efficient ways. Swimmers learn to perform their strokes in ways that maximize thrust and minimize drag. Runners learn to stride in ways that maximize speed and endurance while conserving energy. Pole vaulters, tennis players, martial artists, golfers, hitters in baseball, three-point shooters in basketball, weightlifters, skeet shooters, and downhill skiers. For all of these athletes, proper form is key to good performance, and the performers with the best mental representations will have an advantage over the rest. In these areas, too, the virtuous circle rules. Honing the skill improves mental representation, and mental representation helps hone the skill. There is a bit of a chicken and egg component to this. Take figure skating. It's hard to have a clear mental representation of what a double axel feels like until you've done it. And likewise, it is difficult to do a clean double axel without a good mental representation of one. That sounds paradoxical, but it isn't really. You work up to a double axel bit by bit, assembling the mental representations as you go. It's like a staircase that you climb as you build it. Each step of your ascent puts you in a position to build the next step. Then you build that step, and you're in a position to build the next one, and so on. Your existing mental representations guide your performance and allow you to both monitor and judge that performance. As you push yourself to do something new, to develop a new skill or sharpen an old one, you are also expanding and sharpening your mental representations, which will in turn make it possible for you to do more than you could before. Chapter 4. The Gold Standard. What is missing from purposeful practice? What is required beyond simply focusing and pushing beyond one's comfort zone? Let's talk about it. As we saw in Chapter 1, purposeful practice, as done by different people, can have very different results. Steve Falloon reached the point where he could remember up to 82 digits, while Renee, working just as hard as Steve, was unable to get beyond 20. The difference lay in the details of the types of practice that Steve and Renee used to improve their memory. Since Steve first demonstrated that it is possible to memorize long strings of numbers, dozens of memory competitors have developed digit memories beyond what Steve achieved. According to the World Memory Sports Council, which oversees international memory competitions, there are now at least 5 people who have managed to remember 300 or more digits in a memory competition, and several dozen who have memorized at least 100 digits. As of November 2015, the world record in this event was held by Sogbadrak Sakanbayar of Mongolia, who recalled 432 digits at the 2015 Taiwan Open Adult Memory Competition. That's more than 5 times as many digits as Steve's record. As with the disparity between Renee and Steve, the key difference between Steve's performance and that of the new generation of memory whizzes lies in the details of their training. This is part of a general pattern. In every area, some approaches to training are more effective than others. In this chapter, we'll explore the most effective method of all: deliberate practice. It is the gold standard, the ideal to which anyone learning a skill should aspire. A highly developed field. Some activities, such as playing music in pop music groups, solving crossword puzzles, and folk dancing, have no standard training approaches. Whatever methods there are seem slapdash and produce unpredictable results. Other activities, like classical music performance, mathematics, and ballet, are blessed with highly developed, broadly accepted training methods. If one follows these methods carefully and diligently, one will almost surely become an expert. I've spent my career studying this second sort of field. These fields have several characteristics in common. First, there are always objective ways, such as the win-loss of a chess competition or a head-to-head race, or at least semi-objective ways, such as evaluation by expert judges, to measure performance. This makes sense. If there is no agreement on what good performance is and no way to tell what changes would improve performance, then it is very difficult, often impossible, to develop effective training methods. If you don't know for sure what constitutes improvement, how can you develop methods to improve performance? Second, these fields tend to be competitive enough that performers have strong incentive to practice and improve. Third, these fields are generally well established, with the relevant skills having been developed over decades or even centuries. And fourth, these fields have a subset of performers who also serve as teachers and coaches, and who, over time, have developed increasingly sophisticated sets of training techniques that make possible the field's steadily increasing skill level. The improvement of skills and the development of training techniques move forward hand in hand, with new training techniques leading to new levels of accomplishment and new accomplishments generating innovations in training. The virtuous circle again. This joint development of skills and training techniques has, up to now at least, always been carried out through trial and error, with the field's practitioners experimenting with various ways to improve, keeping what works and discarding what doesn't. No field adheres more strongly to these principles than musical training, particularly on the violin and the piano. This is a competitive field, and one in which the development of the requisite skills and training methods has been going on for several hundred years. Furthermore, it is an area that, at least in the case of the violin and piano, generally requires 20 or more years of steady practice if you were to take your place among the best in the world. In short, it is a natural field, and quite likely the very best field, to study for anyone wishing to understand expert performance. And, luckily, it's the field I studied in the years after I had completed my research on expert performance in memory. In the fall of 1987, I took a position at the Max Planck Institute for Human Development. After finishing my memory studies with Steve Falloon, I had followed up by studying other examples of exceptional memory, such as waiters who could recall the detailed orders of many customers without writing them down, and stage actors who had to learn many lines every time they began a new play. In each case, I had studied the mental representations that these people developed in order to build their memory. But they all had a major limitation. They were amateurs who had undergone no formal training, but had just figured it out as they went along. What sorts of achievement might be possible with rigorous, formal training methods? When I moved to Berlin, I suddenly had the chance to observe just such methods in musicians. That opportunity arose thanks to the presence of the Universität der Künste Berlin, or in English, the Berlin University of the Arts, which is located not far from the Max Planck Institute. The university has 3,600 students in four colleges: a College of Fine Arts, a College of Architecture, a College of Media and Design, and a College of Music and the Performing Arts. And the Music Academy, in particular, is highly regarded for both its teaching and its student body. Its alumni include the conductors Otto Klemperer and Bruno Walter, two giants of 20th century conducting, and the composer Kurt Weill, best known for the Threepenny Opera, and in particular for its popular song Mack the Knife. Year after year, the Academy turns out pianists, violinists, composers, conductors, and other musicians who go on to take their places among Germany's and the world's elite artists. At the Max Planck Institute, I recruited two collaborators, Rolf Krampe, a graduate student at the Institute, and Clemens Tesch-Romer, a postdoctoral fellow there. And together, we mapped out an investigation into the development of musical accomplishment. Originally, the plan was to focus on the motivations of the music students. In particular, I was curious as to whether musicians' motivations would explain how much practice they engaged in, and thus explain, at least in part, how accomplished they became. Ralph, Clements, and I chose to limit ourselves to the Academy's violin students. Because the school was well known for turning out world-class violinists, many of those students would likely rank among the world's best violinists in a decade or two. Not all of them were quite so accomplished, of course. The Academy had a range of violin students, from good to very good to great, and this gave us the opportunity to compare the motivation of the various students with their levels of accomplishment. We first asked the professors at the Music Academy to identify students who had the potential to have careers as international soloists, the very upper tier of professional violinists. These were the superstars in waiting, the students who intimidated all their classmates. The professors came up with 14 names. Of those, three were not fluent in German, and thus would be difficult to interview, and one was pregnant and wouldn't be able to practice in a normal manner. That left us with 10 best students, 7 women and 3 men. The professors also identified a number of violin students who were very good but not superstar good. We chose 10 of them and matched them with the first 10 by age and sex. These were the better students. Finally, we selected another 10 age and sex-matched violinists from the music education department at the school. These students would most likely end up as music teachers, and while they were certainly skilled musicians, when compared to the rest of us, they were clearly less skilled than the violinists in either of the other two groups. Many of the music teachers had unsuccessfully applied to be admitted to the soloist program, and then had been accepted into the music teacher program. This was our good group, which gave us 3 groups that had achieved very different levels of performance: good, better, and best. We also recruited 10 middle-aged violinists from the Berlin Philharmonic Orchestra, now the Berlin Philharmonic, and the Radio Symphonie Orchester Berlin, 2 orchestras with international reputations. The music teachers at the Academy had told us that their best students were likely to end up performing in one of these orchestras or in ensembles of similar quality elsewhere in Germany. Thus, the violinists from these orchestras served as a look to the future, a glimpse of what the best violinists in the Music Academy were likely to be in another 20 or 30 years. Our goal was to understand what separated the truly outstanding student violinists from those who were merely good. The traditional view held that differences among individuals performing at these highest levels would be due primarily to innate talent. So differences in the amount and type of practice, in essence, differences in motivation, wouldn't matter at this level. We were looking to see if this traditional view was wrong. The challenge of the violin. It is hard to describe the difficulty of playing a violin, and thus to explain how much skill a good violinist actually has, to someone whose only contact with the violin has been to hear it played by a professional. In the right hands, no instrument sounds more beautiful. But put in the wrong hands and you might as well step on a cat's tail and listen to the sounds that result. Coaxing just a single acceptable note from a violin, one that doesn't screech or squawk or whistle, one that is neither flat nor sharp, one that captures the tone of the instrument, requires a great deal of practice, and learning to play that single note well is just the first step in a long and challenging journey. The difficulties start with the fact that the violin's fingerboard has no frets. The metal ridges found on a guitar's fingerboard that divide it into separate notes and guarantee, as long as the guitar is in tune, each note played will sound neither flat nor sharp. Because the violin has no frets, the violinist must put his or her fingers at exactly the right spot on the fingerboard to produce the desired note. A 1/16 of an inch off the mark and the note will be flat or sharp. If the finger is too far from the correct position, the result is a completely different note from the one that was desired. And that's just one note. Every note up and down the fingerboard requires the same precision. Violinists spend countless hours doing scales so that they can move the fingers of their left hand correctly from one note to the next, whether up or down on a single string or moving from one string to another. And once they are comfortable with placing their fingers in exactly the right spots on the fingerboard, There are various subtleties of fingering to master, beginning with vibrato, which is a rolling, not a sliding, of the fingertip up and down the string, which causes the note to shimmer. More hours and hours of practice. Furthermore, the fingering is actually the easy part. Using the bow properly poses another whole level of difficulty. As the bow is drawn across a string, the horsehair of the bow catches the string and drags it a bit, then lets it slip, catches it again, lets it slip, and so on, hundreds or even thousands of times a second, depending on the frequency of the string's vibrations. The particular way that the string moves in response to the bow's drag and release action gives the violin its distinctive sound. Violinists control the volume of their playing by varying the pressure of the bow on the string. But that pressure must stay within a certain range. Too much, and the result is an awful squawking noise, while too little leads to a sound that, while less offensive, isn't considered acceptable. To complicate matters further, the range of acceptable pressures varies according to the bow's position along the string. The closer the bow is to the bridge, the more force is needed to stay within the sweet spot. Violinists must learn to move the bow across the strings in a variety of ways in order to vary the sound that is produced. The bow can be drawn smoothly across the strings, stopped momentarily, sawed quickly back and forth, picked up and dropped back down on the strings, allowed to bounce gently off the strings, and so on. More than a dozen bowing techniques in all. Spiccato, for example, involves bouncing the bow off and back onto a string as the bow moves back and forth across the string, producing a series of short staccato notes. Sautille is a faster version of spiccato. Then there are jeté, collé, détaché, martelé, legato, and luré, and more. Each technique with its own distinctive sound. And, of course, all of these bow techniques must be done in close coordination with the left hand as it fingers the strings. These are not skills that can be picked up in a year or two of practice. Indeed, all of the students we studied had been playing for well over a decade. The average age at which they started was 8, and they had all followed the training pattern that is standard for children today. That is, they began systematic, focused lessons very early on, visiting a music teacher usually once a week. During that weekly meeting, the student's current musical performance was evaluated by the teacher, who identified a couple of immediate goals for improvement and assigned some practice activities that a motivated student would be able to attain with solitary practice during the week before the next meeting. Because most students spend the same amount of time each week with the music teacher, an hour, the primary difference in practice from one student to the next lies in how much time the students devote to solitary practice. Among serious students, such as the ones who ended up in the Berlin Academy, it's not unusual for 10 and 11-year-olds to be spending 15 hours a week on focused practice, during which time they are following lessons designed by their teachers to develop specific techniques. And as they get older, the serious students generally increase their amount of weekly practice time. One of the things that differentiates violin training from training in other areas, soccer, for example, or algebra, is that the set of skills expected of a violinist is quite standardized, as are many of the instruction techniques. Because most violin techniques are decades or even centuries old, the field has had the chance to zero in on the proper or best way to hold the violin, to move the hand during vibrato, to move the bow during spiccato, and so on. The various techniques may not be easy to master, but a student can be shown exactly what to do and how to do it. All this means is that the violin students at the Universität der Künste Berlin offered a near-perfect opportunity to test the role that motivation plays in developing expert performance, and more generally, to identify what differentiates good performers from the very best. Good versus better versus best. To look for these differences, we interviewed each of the 30 student violinists in our study in great detail. We asked them about their musical histories, when they started studying music, who their teachers were, how many hours a week they spent in solitary practice at each age, what competitions they'd won, and so on. We asked them for their opinions on how important various activities were in improving their performance. Practicing alone, practicing in a group, playing alone for fun, playing in a group for fun, performing solo, performing in a group, taking lessons, giving lessons, listening to music, studying music theory, and so on. We asked them how much effort these various activities required, and how much immediate pleasure they got while they were doing them. We asked them to estimate how much time they'd spent on each of these activities during the previous week. Finally, because we were interested in how much time they'd spent on practice over the years, we asked them to estimate, for each year since they'd started to practice music, how many hours per week on average they'd spent in solitary practice. The 30 music students were also asked to keep daily diaries for each of the next 7 days, in which they would detail exactly how they'd spent their time. In the diaries, they recorded their activities in 15-minute increments, sleeping, eating, going to class, studying, practicing alone, practicing with others, performing, and so on. When they were done, we had a detailed picture of how they'd spent their days, as well as a very good idea of their practice histories. The students from all three groups gave similar answers to most of our questions. The students pretty much all agreed, for instance, that solitary practice was the most important factor in improving their performance, followed by such things as practicing with others, taking lessons, performing, particularly in solo performance, listening to music, and studying music theory. Many of them also said that getting enough sleep was very important to their improvement. Because their practice was so intense, they needed to recharge their batteries with a full night's sleep, and often an afternoon nap. One of our most significant findings was that most factors the students had identified as being important to improvement were also seen as labor-intensive and not much fun. The only exceptions were listening to music and sleeping. Everyone from the very top students to the future music teachers agreed. Improvement was hard, and they didn't enjoy the work they did to improve. In short, there were no students who just loved to practice and thus needed less motivation than the others. These students were motivated to practice intensely and with full concentration because they saw such practice as essential to improving their performance. The other crucial finding was that there was only one major difference among the three groups. This was the total number of hours that the students had devoted to solitary practice. Using the students' estimates of how many hours a week they'd practiced alone since they'd begun playing the violin, we calculated the total number of hours they'd spent practicing alone until age 18, the age at which they typically entered the music academy. Although memories are not always reliable, dedicated students of this sort generally set aside fixed periods to practice each day on a weekly schedule, and they do this beginning very early on in their music training. So we thought it likely that their retrospective estimates of how much time they had spent practicing at various ages would be relatively accurate. We found that the best violin students had, on average, spent significantly more time than the better violin students had spent, and that the top two groups, better and best, had spent much more time on solitary practice than the music education students. Specifically, the music education students had practiced an average of 3,420 hours on the violin by the time they were 18. The better violin students had practiced an average of 5,301 hours, and the best violin students had practiced an average of 7,410 hours. Nobody had been slacking. Even the least accomplished of the students had put in thousands of hours of practice, far more than anyone would have who played the violin just for fun. But these were clearly major differences in practice time. Looking more closely, we found that the largest differences in practice time among the three groups of students had come in the preteen and teenage years. This is a particularly challenging time for young people to keep up their music practice because of the many interests that compete for their time: studying, shopping, hanging out with friends, partying, and so on. Our results indicated that those preteens and teens who could maintain and even increase their heavy practice schedule during these years ended up in the top group of violinists at the academy. We also calculated estimated practice times for the middle-aged violinists working at the Berlin Philharmonic and the Radio-Symphonie-Orchester Berlin. And we found that the time they had spent practicing before the age of 18, an average of 7,336 hours, was almost identical to what the best violin students in the Music Academy had reported. There were a number of factors we did not include in our study that could have influenced, and indeed probably did influence, the skill levels of the violinists in the different groups. For instance, students who were lucky enough to have worked with exceptional teachers would likely have progressed more quickly than those with teachers who were just okay. But two things were strikingly clear from the study. First, to become an excellent violinist requires several thousand hours of practice. We found no shortcuts and no prodigies who reached an expert level with relatively little practice. And second, even among these gifted musicians, all of whom had been admitted to the best music academy in Germany, the violinists who had spent significantly more hours practicing their craft were on average more accomplished than those who had spent less time practicing. The same pattern that we saw among the student violinists has been seen among performers in other areas. Observing this pattern accurately depends on being able to get a good estimate of the total number of hours of practice people have put into developing a skill, which is not always easy to do, and also on being able to tell with some objectivity who the good, better, and best are in a given field, which is also not always easy to do. But when you can do those two things, you generally find that the best performers are those who have spent the most time in various types of purposeful practice. Just a few years ago, I and two colleagues, Carla Hutchinson and Natalie Sachs-Erickson, who is also my wife, studied a group of ballet dancers to see what role practice played in their achievements. The dancers we worked with were from the Bolshoi Ballet in Russia, the National Ballet of Mexico, and three companies in the United States, the Boston Ballet, the Dance Theater of Harlem, and the Cleveland Ballet. We gave them questionnaires to learn when they started training and how many hours a week they devoted over time to practice, which consisted mainly of practice time spent in a studio under the direction of an instructor. And we specifically excluded rehearsals and performances. We judged a dancer's skill level by determining what sort of ballet company he or she had performed with, a regional company such as the Cleveland Ballet, or a national company, such as the Dance Theater of Harlem, or an international company, such as the Bolshoi, or the Boston Ballet, and also by determining the highest level the dancer had reached inside the company, whether a principal dancer, a soloist, or just a member of the troupe. The average age of the dancers was 26, but the youngest was 18. So to have an apples-to-apples comparison, we looked at the accumulated amount of practice through age 17 and the skill level at age 18. Though we were working with fairly crude measures, both of the total hours of practice and of the dancers' abilities, there was still a relatively strong relationship between the reported amount of time spent on practice and how high a dancer had risen in the world of ballet, with the dancers who practiced more being better dancers, at least according to the troupes they danced with and the positions they held in the troupes. There was no significant difference between dancers from different countries in terms of how many hours of practice they needed to reach a certain level of proficiency. As with the violinists, the only significant factor determining an individual ballet dancer's ultimate skill level was the total number of hours devoted to practice. When we calculated how much time the dancers had spent on practice through age 20, we found that they had averaged more than 10,000 hours of practice. Some dancers had put in much more time than this average, however, while others had put in much less. And this difference in training corresponded to the difference between good, better, and best among the dancers. Again, we found no sign of anyone born with the sort of talent that would make it possible to reach the upper levels of ballet without working as hard or harder than anyone else. Other studies of ballet dancers have shown the same thing. By now, it is safe to conclude from many studies on a wide variety of disciplines that nobody develops extraordinary abilities without putting in tremendous amounts of practice. I do not know of any serious scientist who doubts that conclusion. No matter which area you study, music, dance, sports, competitive games, or anything else with objective measures of performance, you find that the top performers have devoted a tremendous amount of time to developing their abilities. We know from studies of the world's best chess players, for example, that almost no one reaches